It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Welcome to Lighthouse Faith Podcast, where we are moving forward in truth and love. I'm Lauren Green, chief religion correspondent for Fox News Channel and author of the book, Lighthouse Faith. We are embarking on a series of podcasts looking at how children are really at the mercy of culture that doesn't really protect them and how it is manifested in their actions and beliefs. On this episode, we're taking a look at the Generation Z. Those are people born between like the 1990s and 2010. So there are people between the ages of their early teens to early 30s. And sort of the golden age is probably in the college age area there. It is a generation where we can see the effects of having very little to no faith in God or organized religion. It's a generation that is a living example of the fact that, you know, if you don't believe in God, you believe in anything. You believe in something. It's a generation that displays the you don't have a choice of whether to believe, only what to believe in. And a new study shows their beliefs make them more intolerant to people who don't share their views. Now, Dr. Alex McFarlane, he's a theologian who speaks to young people all over the country. He's authored or co-authored more than 20 books, including The Assault on America, How to Defend Our Nation Before It's Too Late, 10 Issues That Divide Christians, The God You Thought You Knew, and many more. He directs Biblical Worldview and teaches in the School of Practical Government for Charis Bible College. It's located in Woodland Park Company, or Colorado Company. Yes, Alex is laughing because I'm not a doctor. Okay, no. But his Alex McFarlane Ministries hosts viral truth campus clubs all across America. Alex is a great friend of Lighthouse Faith Podcast and is always able to bring things into the proper light. Welcome, Alex.
Well, thank you, Lauren. It's great to be here with you in New York City. We do so many things by Zoom or remotely. So.
I know. We're coming out of COVID finally, so you're actually in the studio now. It's really fun.
And thank you for having me. And may I commend you for the great work you do. I travel all over the country, and a lot of people know that I've been on various broadcasts with you. And everywhere I go, everywhere, people have such great things to say about the work of Lauren Green.
Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'm really fascinated by this Gen Z. I mean, you and I are much older, and so we kind of forget about what it's like for them to grow up. And we see more and more in the stats that there are more nuns, that they say there are more people growing up who have no relation to religion, no belief in an organized religion, and they're sort of kind of finding their spirituality on their own, which is actually quite dangerous. I mean, you and I grew up in an environment where, you know, mom and dad brought us to Sunday school.
Sure.
And so your idea of morality is based on what you learned there and how, and your family structure was based on that. And these kids don't grow up with that, but they have beliefs. And this is what is interesting, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And let me say, kids are spiritually hungry. They really are. But the state of morality and religion in our nation is directly contingent on the state of the family. And we could talk about culture, and there's a lot to say about the trends in culture and government and politics and ideologies. But, Lauren, I believe that the reason that there is rejection of belief in God, ambiguity about morals, there's this crisis of truth because there's a crisis within the family.
What is the crisis in the family? Let's get to that first, because that's where kids are influenced most early on, and that's their early influence is what stays with them.
Sure. Well, so many young people are the products of a broken home or a home that never was. Mm-hmm. You know, very often people talk about, quote, the traditional family, mm-hmm. a mother and dad. And, you know, whenever I'm at universities and I'll be on panel discussions, you know, sometimes almost sarcastically, they'll say, well, you know, it's not the 1950s and Ozzie and Harriet and the mom and the dad and the white.
Yes, there's a quite disparaging of, you know, that traditional home life.
Yeah, exactly. Among the left, there is a real condescension and dismissive posture about mom, dad, husband, wife, family, and yet uniformly, but besides scripture, volumes of psychological literature and studies show that the best context for a young person to grow up in is in a stable, loving, two-parent home with their biological mom and dad.
Why is it that we can see the evidence, and if we look at just the evidence, are there so many voices that are disparaging that very, very simple kind of upbringing?
Well, the minister in me knows that people want to be their own God. People don't want to have boundaries and have to say, you know what, there are objective moral truths, and I have not lived up to them, and in fact have actively tried to break them. You know, I mean, when you talk about right and wrong, Lauren, it gets convicting. And very often people in positions of authority with PhDs, rather than admit, look, over the last 60, 70 years, we've gotten some things wrong. Dr. Spock was wrong. Children do need discipline.
Yeah.
Helen Gurley Brown and Cosmopolitan and the women's liberation movements had some things wrong that... There is this human desire for the nest and stability and a sanctuary and a home life. And mom and dad can raise the child better than the secular educator and the social sociological architects. So there are people in the culture that personally and collectively would do well to admit that, you know, traditional values, they worked for about 6,000 years of human history, you know.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you this, Lauren. I just came from Western North Carolina. We had a retreat, a four-day winter retreat that concluded on Monday. And there were 183 teenagers from about five states. So I've got cards that, you know, I always do surveys with young people. A middle school girl, because we were talking about the clubs that we start called Viral Truth. She said, we have a club at our school. She was a sixth grader. She said, we have a SAD club. Mm. Now, I thought, is that an acronym for Students Against Drunk Driving? You know, it wasn't that. She said, so many of my friends are sad, and we try to encourage each other. So the SAD club is like the biggest club at her middle school. And I said, what are you sad about? She said, well, our family... I never get to see our dad. My parents are always fighting. The future. And they may not be able to articulate it as well as, you know, the pundits. But middle schoolers are concerned about the state of our nation, open borders, you know, crime. And to our original question about the war on children, I mean, kids are smart enough to realize that our culture needs help. And so it just blew my mind that a girl would tell me they've got a SAD club because so many of her peers, they're afraid and they're sad.
There's so much pressure on them, too. How much does social media play into that? Because a lot more of these, probably all of them now, are on social media, and this is where their sort of interaction with their friends or pseudo-friends are.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a Photoshop-filtered TikTok world, and yet when we get away, and I do think spending so much time online is maybe a little bit of an escape, because there's so much about what's on social media that's just not real.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe it's a little bit of an escape.
I mean, we used to talk to each other on the phone.
Yeah, sure.
You could only talk to one person on the phone at a time.
No, that's true, though, and that is real intimacy and human-to-human interaction. You know, kids nowadays, they may or may not be talking to a human. They may be chatting with some AI, you know.
Right.
But the thing is, all of the connection of technology has made us less socialized with each other. And, I mean, it's just axiomatic about I'm generalizing, I know, so I want to preemptively ask forgiveness for what I'm about to say. Not all, but many millennials don't have a lot of social skills. Some do, some don't. But kids, you know, just being able to converse with a stranger or even, you know, go to any major retailer and you can see the students working, and I commend them that they're working, but when it comes to customer service or just people skills and extemporaneous conversation, they really push back from that because they've not had all maybe the socialization you and I had growing up. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is that technology is not rationed by mom and dad. One thing I do in my parenting seminars and counseling, mom and dad, you've got to set some boundaries for the use of technology in the home.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you owe it to your child that they should not spend 7 to 9 hours on screen a day.
Yeah.
Which is what many kids do.
You know, Mary Eberstadt wrote that book, Primal Scream, and she talks about the problems of the sexual revolution has caused so many other problems because it filters down into separating love from sex. You know, it's no longer in the boundary of marriage. It is in, you know, by the time somebody gets married, they've had multiple sex partners. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from a biblical point of view, sex is meant to bind two people, a man and woman, together in holy matrimony for life. Mm-hmm. Now, when you have sex and you don't marry that person, it's like you're ripping the tape off constantly, and then it no longer has the glue to keep the relationship together. How much has the sexual revolution contributed to what's happening with young people today?
I think hugely so. Hugely so. And it's almost like the sexual revolution and increasing levels of explicitness within media have run parallel to the increasing abandonment of boundaries and commitment in the culture. You know, years ago, Cal Thomas wrote an article called The Diminishing Returns of Explicitness. Mm. And like, oh, my goodness. Nowadays, they say that 47% of pastors look at online pornography in the course of a week.
Oh, my gosh.
Pornography, Jordan Peterson, the Canadian psychologist who I appreciate so much, has done a lot about just the detrimental effect of pornography, whether it be, you know, I mean, there's gradations of porn, and whether it's a drug addict, as they say, chasing the dragon, people that get addicted to sex or get addicted to online porn, I mean, to have the stimulation and to get the rush, there's got to be increasing levels of deviancy and things like that. Now, we're living in a time when kids at 6, 7 years old will have seen pornographic images because invariably online, this is why mom and dad need to supervise what your kids are watching online. Kids today, what you and I would have grown up about purity and saving oneself till marriage.
Right, right.
And then there's commitment and you're married and you stay with your spouse and you are there for your kids. I mean, that just seems almost like a fairy tale that no longer is and maybe even never was.
And not only that, if someone actually tries to live that way, they get very little encouragement from their peer group.
That's right.
And not only do they not get encouragement, they probably are maligned and made fun of because of that.
And here's the irony. And again, secular studies show this, bear this out. The people that have the greatest levels of intimacy have more sex and over a longer period of time, and it's meaningful and committed, are married people, traditional married, you know, for a long period of time. The irony is, and this is really the lie of there was Oz Guinness, I'm sure you've probably interviewed.
Sure.
He wrote an article some years ago called The Striptease of Humanism, how it's a tease and it's a lie. And really, the people who have less sex and less satisfying sex are the people that have abandoned traditional values. And the Hugh Hefner, I mean, my goodness, what a tragic figure, not to mention immeasurably detrimental figure Hugh Hefner was.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we're at a culture that tried an experiment mid-20th century. Life without God, life without morals, life without truth, life without boundaries. And rather than setting us free, we find ourselves orphaned, if not enslaved.
It's really, really, really disturbing. And one of the things that you talk about, which I thought was very interesting, one of the things that there's actually first things I wanted to talk about this, because First Things magazine came out with a a lead story this week about the drag racing or the drag phenomenon, how it's become mainstream, and how it's being pushed into younger and younger kids with, you know, the drag queen, you know, reading hour or something at the library.
Yeah, yeah.
And the irony is that it is it is actually more misogynistic and more detrimental and more insulting of women than men. That's the irony.
Yeah.
The fact that you're actually,
I would agree,
that you're actually pushing this on children, and because it's become mainstream, the greater proponents of drag, you know, drag whatever,
yeah,
are liberal women.
Yeah, I mean, and really, again, in the quest to call the shots for myself, and nobody's going to impose their agenda on me and label me, what happens is we really undermine the rights and the respect and the personhood of females, and to a degree males. Let me say this, Lauren, if I may, parenthetically. Whenever we talk about, you know, gender dysphoria or homosexual ideation, understand this, and I believe this to the core of my soul, and my interest in this topic began in a grad course under a UCLA medical school professor 25 years ago. So what I'm about to say is not right-wing religion. Mm-hmm. This is secular psychology that you really don't hear in the mainstream media. But homosexual ideation and gender dysphoria is a means of attempting to deal with pain. For those that experience same-sex attraction in pre-adolescence or adolescence, and for those that are confused about gender, there are contributing factors, the top four being, in this order, number one, lack of bonding with the parent of the same sex. Number two, early childhood molestation. Number three, early childhood exposure to pornography. And then number four, other early childhood trauma like domestic violence, divorce, physical abuse, verbal abuse. So here's the thing. As kids exit childhood and there's pre-adolescence and puberty begins, and we all know that, you know, that's a time every one of us, you know, we've got to kind of find ourselves, and as Abraham Maslow would have said, become self-actualized in the sense we begin to get a sense of self and a sense of identity and stability. Well, when kids, you know, a little boy learns masculinity from dad, a young lady learns femininity from mom, right?
Right.
And then when there is this tragic wounding of the psyche by sexual abuse, and this is so terrible, one of the ways that we try to cope with those pains and that almost panic of not really knowing who I am, and what's so sad is, children that have been violated, very oftentimes they wonder, this is my fault. Did I bring this on myself? You know, it's so sad. And it's no surprise, actually, that the rise of homosexuality and transgenderism has run on a parallel track over the last 50 years with the breakdown of the family and no-fault divorce. And, you know, 50 to 60, 60% plus of children that aren't raised with mom and dad. And I've counseled many people, and believe me, I realize that a lot of what I'm saying.
Well, I know you realize what a lot of what you're going to say. People push back on it. They've got. Let's take a break right now here on Fox, on Lighthouse Faith Podcast, because I want to get into this area, because it's very important that we balance it out with what the APA now is saying. Of course,
yes.
We'll be right back.
This is Jimmy Fallon, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a three-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
And we're back at Lighthouse Faith Podcast with Dr. Alex McFarlane, who is many things, author, but has ministries, and he hosts the Viral Truth Campus Clubs. But we were talking about something that has become incredibly controversial, which is the idea of the rise of transgenderism, and it seems the acceptability of homosexuality and same-sex marriage, all of those things. One of the things that's actually behind this is the APA, the American Psychological Association, which diseased homosexuality in the 70s,
right.
not from a study, mm-hmm. but from a vote. It
right.
was really a political decision. And I think that's very, very clear. And what it's done is that we can't have the kind of conversations anymore that you're bringing up.
That's right.
That conversation is 25 years ago. That's what they're going to say because you said you had this study, that you had this information from a UCLA professor 25 years ago. And they will say, yes, because that's 25 years ago. We know so much more now.
Right. The definitive book on that is called Homosexuality and the Politics of Truth by Dr. Jeffrey Satinover. And he was at Albert Einstein School of Medicine and an MIT grad. One of the most mind-boggling resumes, like 6 masters and 3...
Yeah. I've read that book. It is mind-boggling.
It is a fascinating book. And, you know, I want to be unequivocally clear. I'm only speaking for myself here. What I'm sharing is not anybody's opinion but my own. But in ministry, you know, and I do a lot of counseling, and it's an honor to try to invest myself in helping people. But literally hundreds of people over the last 30 years that have come to my office hurting. Is there hope? People that have immersed themselves in homosexual relationships, multiple partners, cross-dressing. I mean, I did the funeral of a cross-dressing man, and the last year of his life, he found for the first time in his life real joy, but it wasn't in the lifestyle that he had been pursuing. It was in a relationship with Christ. And he had been rejected by his father and had been physically and verbally abused. And it was just revelatory, Lauren, when he learned of the unconditional love of God. And I know right now, God, the Bible, Jesus, we could take a different tack and talk about why I believe those things are real. Maybe mm-hmm. that's another subject for another show. But just for the purpose of this conversation, I really do believe, Lauren, that compelling lines of evidence point to the existence of God, the trustworthiness of the Bible, and the reality of Jesus Christ. So for hurting people, regardless of the pathology or pain, the reality that there is a God who loves them and is unconditional, and his grace is unlimited, inexhaustible. I think that's a message that people need to hear. Children need to hear it.
Well, you know, we're going to go back to the Gen Z generation because this is very interesting in their manifestation of really not having, of growing up with really not a lot of beliefs in God. They're not brought to Sunday school. They don't learn the Ten Commandments. They don't learn the Bible stories. But there is a feeling that something is definitely right and something is wrong. They know this, but they don't know where that comes from. You and I know that comes from the ultimate creator who has put in us the sense of right and wrong and law and justice.
Right.
But one of the things you discovered is that they are incredibly intolerant of people who don't share their views. What is this? Tell me where this comes from and tell me what they're intolerant about.
Well, it's the outgrowth of the philosophy of relativism that I can make my own truth. And I mean, kids learn this in school. Kids, I had a parent call me about a week ago, took his 8-year-old to the doctor, a pediatrician in North Carolina, and the doctor knelt down eye to eye and said to the 8-year-old, "Do you want to be a boy or do you want to be a girl?"
Oh my goodness.
And the parent was about to speak, and the doctor was like, "No, let the child answer." And the little boy said to the doctor, and I quote, said, "Duh, I'm a guy." But, you know, the insistence upon relativism has woven itself so deeply into our culture, Lauren. I mean, when you've got medical doctors, and look, I understand what celebrities and talking heads can say about whatever they want, but, you know, we're talking about science here. You and I, we live in a world where we're told, follow the science. Well, in the history of mammalian biology, mm-hmm. I mean, there are males and there are females. Procreation involves male and female. Human beings are, you know, XY chromosome males, XX females. And yet a doctor a pediatrician to say to a child, what do you want to be, a boy or a girl? That says you can create your own reality.
Which is funny because you wouldn't let a child decide if he wants to walk across the street on a red light or a green light.
No.
What do you want to do?
Exactly. Exactly. You would not give an 8-year-old the keys to a sports car. There are some things about life that are simply beyond our ability to control. You know, where we were born, the family into which we were born, and our gender. And do you know, it goes back to God. Lauren, there comes a point when we just have to acknowledge that there are some parameters of life that I, despite my insistence, I cannot change.
Mm-hmm.
I'm never going to be George Clooney, you know? But somehow I...
Well, he's never going to be Alex McFarlane.
Yeah, he's grateful for that, I'm sure. But, you know, we've got to trust that the good Lord just knew. And this goes back to the Psalms, really, if I can... invoke the Bible a little bit. Psalm 16, verse 6, very interesting verse. It says, the boundary lines have fallen to me in pleasant places. Yes, I have a godly heritage. God, Almighty God, sets some of those boundary lines. And one of the boundaries that God chose, not us, is our gender.
Mm.
And really, let me just say this about moral relativism coming to its fullest fruition. See, it's one thing to say, God, you can't tell me how to behave. The 60s and the 70s were a lot about overthrowing old mores and
right.
norms.
Right.
You know, Abby Hoffman wrote, steal this book, never trust anyone over 30. And if it feels good, do it. And, Jim Morrison of the Doors would scream, there are no rules, there are no laws, grab your
right.
neighbor and love him. Okay. But 50 years ago, we said, God, you can't tell me how to behave. Today, we're saying, God, you don't even have the right to tell me who I am.
Wow.
And so I would say among young people, and I wrote an article here, Gen Z, Zillennials, Reels, Soggies, it's almost like sociologists struggle to create accurate acronyms to describe, you know, where the youth are. But there's a crisis of identity. Now, think about this for a second. Like, let's say you've got, you're on the horns of a dilemma. You don't know, should I take the job in Minneapolis? Should I take the job in Manhattan?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, processing a decision can be a struggle. But kids today that are in adolescence and they're going to young adulthood, I mean, the struggle used to be, what will I do? Will I get a degree in this or that? What will, they don't know who they are. And my heart breaks. And I've watched kids and their parents weep because there is a crisis of identity. And one of the most fundamental knowledge points that is a precursor for a healthy life is to have a sense of who I am.
Well, and also that's actually one of the reasons why the real intolerance for views other than their own has to do with gender identity. And transgenderism and all of those things, because if you don't agree with this, you're a hate monger. It's not that you disagree. It's that we don't want you to think like that. Mm-hmm. There's something wrong with you foundationally if you think like that. And this has become the new salvation of Gen Z, is my gender identity. That's my salvation, not God.
Right.
Whatever. But then it draws to the question that a certain amount of what makes a woman and a man a man is a lot of gender socialization,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
You have to be socialized into a certain understanding of what makes a male and female. My cats are, don't really do that because they kind of just are cats. They don't understand.
Right.
But people should understand. And there's a certain amount of gender socialization. But the Bible talks about male and female. It does not talk about uber machismo, Marlboro men, everybody got to strive to be like Tom Brady kind of, male.
Right, right.
Or uber feminine, beauty queen, in sort of the caricature of that feminine probably are the drag racers.
And have you noticed how often the drag queens are a caricature?
Yeah.
You know, like I've seen some of the pictures of the drag queen story hour that's at some of the public libraries. And, you know, it's always or virtually always very, very over the top. And it's something less than human.
Well, then there's also something that's the article brought out was that the drag queens often call themselves very disparaging names of on women. Even RuPaul's drag queen racing, whatever that is, they're judged on certain things that is an acronym for female genitalia.
Really?
And why would you let men disparage women so much? And the idea is like, I wouldn't call my best friends these names.
Right.
But
right.
yet they call each other these names, and that's part of the mystique of the drag queen culture.
Isn't that something? And it's not respectful, is it? And very often those of us that actually do believe in objective morality, you know, we're called haters or phobic or something like that. But one of the core values of Western culture, and not just Christianity, but Western civ in general, is the value of personhood. And you have rights and you are worthy of respect and deference, not because of how much money you may or not have, but because you're a human being.
Right.
And one of our core values in the human, in the Western world, has been that every person is sacred, really. A person is an end in themselves. When I honor you, I'm honoring the one whose image you bear. And everyone has worth and value and dignity, and indeed they do. But I was going to say this. I thought it was interesting to talk about that. We've got to help young people understand that emotions are not the litmus test for truth. Because
right.
if you're counseling a child about gender confusion, a child might say, "But you don't know how I feel."
Right.
And I understand. Only to a slight degree can we understand how another person feels. But regardless of how you feel, that's not the litmus test for truth. Let me digress here for a second and mention my sister, Caroline Steinbach, and she, I'm sure, will hear this. I'm very close to my sister, 5 years older than me. But she was either the first or the second in the state of North Carolina, about 1975, diagnosed with anorexia nervosa.
Wow.
And in the 70s, they didn't know what eating disorders were. And she was growing up, and it was a classic case. She was growing up, and her girlfriends developed at a certain rate. And, you know, there's body image issues, although we didn't even know the term body issues.
Mm-hmm.
I was just, I don't know. 11 maybe. But anyway, my sister wound up at Duke University, and she had starved herself from being a cherubic little teenage girl to down to, I don't know, 58, 59 pounds.
Wow.
At 15, 16 years old. And I'll never forget, we were with my parents, and Dr. Norman Garrett was his name, medical doctor. He came in. He said, "I've been on the phone with some colleagues in California, anorexia nervosa." All right.
Wow.
Now, here's the thing. What would have been more compassionate to say to my sister, "I know you, she stood in a mirror. I remember this vividly, my skin and bones 16-year-old sister. And she said, "I'm so fat. I'm so fat." And she literally she was admitted to the hospital on IVs because she was about to die. Now, what if I had said, "You know, that's how you identify. Good for you. Be true to your real self." And my parents and my sister's doctors said, "Well, you may feel that way, but we have to intervene because we care enough about you to try to help you understand your feelings are not trustworthy on this subject."
Mm-hmm.
Now, in California, children can get puberty blockers and surgery. We're talking about the castration of children. And parents in California, and I'm told Maine as well, really don't have the legal right to intervene. And we've got to help people understand, especially kids that are struggling with their own development, feelings are not a trustworthy
right.
test for truth in all situations. We have a moral duty to tell the person with an eating disorder, we want you to get good nutrition
right.
because we want you to be healthy. The person with body image issues, we need to say, look, I love you and I'm there for you and nothing can change my love for you, but let's look at some things a little more solid than just our emotions for some lifelong decisions you're about to make.
Wow. Dr. Alex DeForlan, I want to thank you so much for being on Lighthouse Faith Podcast. We could talk for a very long time, and we probably will have you back because it's always interesting to talk to you. I mean, if you have a place where people can go seek advice, if you've brought up some kind of ideas and people are listening to this and they want someplace to go, how would they proceed? Where would you suggest they proceed?
You know, you mentioned Jim Daly, and I had the privilege of working for Focus on the Family for 8 years, and still am in touch with a lot of the folks out there. Focus on the Family has a referral database of counselors in all 50 states, people that are very vetted out, psychologists, psychiatrists, counselors, very trustworthy. And if somebody's listening and they really, you know, in any number of areas, they just need some help and some direction. I think their number is still 1-800-A-FAMILY. I'm not on staff there anymore, but I often, you know.
But there's a website. You can go Focus on the Family.
Focus on the Family. And then our own, my name, which is Alex McFarland, and the website is alexmcfarland.com. We interface. We have staff members that can talk with parents having issues with their children. I've been fortunate enough to speak in about 2,200 cities. So we've got a network of people, whether they be clergy or churches or counselors or ministry programs, and we do our best to refer people to places where their needs can be met.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. As I say, you know, I think there is a war on children.
Yes.
And I think we've just kind of entered the battle because that's all we can do is try to fight back.
Sure. Well, thank you for what you do. I mean, you are part of what's right with America. And as I said earlier, everywhere I go, people know your name. They're benefiting from your content. And I appreciate you and I appreciate Fox.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Alex McFarland. And this has been Lighthouse Faith Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. My name is Lauren Green. Have a very blessed day.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.